This is Audible.
The Borrowed World, a novel of post-apocalyptic collapse, Volume 1, written by Franklin Horton, narrated by Kevin Pierce. Preface. The earliest seeds of this project began during a period of my life when I had to travel frequently for work. During periods of elevated terror alerts, and especially during Hurricane Katrina, I thought often about the vulnerability of a person traveling during a national disaster. It would be difficult to be prepared for all of the possible impediments that a person might encounter. As a way of passing the time during long drives, I developed get-home plans for each trip. Given what I had in my luggage, what avenues of travel would be available to me? What would my route be? What hazards might be encountered on the route? An immediate side effect of asking myself these questions was that I began to pack better for my trips. If I was going to have to walk home, I wanted the shoes to do it in. This is a work of fiction, though. It was not written with the intent of serving as an instructional manual on prepping or building the perfect bug-out bag. There are plenty of excellent books and forums out there already that can guide you through that process. Instead, this is a speculative novel about a person who reads those books and haunts those websites. It is about how a moderately prepared and well-informed person might respond under a particular set of circumstances. It is intended to encourage thought and discussion. Franklin Horton, April 27, 2015. Chapter 1. Imran ul-Haq was eating a late dinner and watching the History Channel. The veal he was eating was exquisitely tender and perfectly seasoned, practically melting in his mouth. It was one of his favorite meals, and the History Channel was one of his favorite channels. The show he was watching was on the disintegration of America's infrastructure. Imran, a plastic surgeon of Syrian descent, now residing in Arlington, Virginia, found the show to be both amusing and fascinating. During the hour-long program, he learned about America's weakened bridges, failing dams, problems with the electrical grid, and the fragility of America's water supply. When the show ended, he was struck with an idea that he felt had practically been thrust into his hands. He smiled. At the end of the program, there was an advertisement which told viewers how to order a DVD of the show. Imran made a note of the website and planned on ordering 5 copies that very evening. 4 of the copies he would send overseas, with no explanation necessary. When the recipients viewed the DVDs, they would see them through the same lens as Imran did. A deadly flower would grow and blossom. The surgeon recalled the attacks on America of September 11th. He envisioned a broader attack. More men. Perhaps permanent devastation, yet somehow less dramatic. Something more visceral and less flashy. Something overall less complicated, because the Americans had done half the work already in allowing vital parts of their nation to weaken to the point that much devastation could be accomplished with very little work. With a few skilled men and a few well-placed munitions, this country could be toppled like a child's stack of building blocks. Imran was certain of it. The producers of the show had practically laid it out for him. This was obviously not work for plastic surgeons, though. Such complex orchestrations would have to be the work of a man with the right connections and significant funding. Such a man could call upon cells of the faithful hiding in plain sight in North America and call them into action. A man on the fringes of a movement such as ISIS would be perfect. A man like his brother. Imran went to his expensive, custom-made walnut bookcase, opened a glass door, and retrieved a mundane text on Islamic history. In Iraq, the same text sat in his brother's living room, on a humbler and likely dustier shelf. Imran sat down at his computer and went to a generic webmail account that he used to communicate with his brother. He began to type a series of numbers. 318, 2898, 9:32. It was a simple system. The numbers instructed his brother as to what page number to go to in the book, and which word to retrieve from that page. When all of the words were retrieved from the book and written out in order, they spelled out a message. This was referred to as a book code, and it was nearly impossible to break unless you happened to have the same copy, same edition, same printing of the book that the sender and receiver were using. When Imran completed his email, he clicked the send button. Before rising from his desk, he ordered the copies of the show he had just seen on the History Channel. His housekeeper had left him a nice chocolate cake for dessert. He placed a modest slice on a china plate and sat back down in front of the television. A show about lumberjacks was on now, and he was particularly fond of it, although they certainly used a lot of profane, heathen language. American television may one day be remembered as its finest achievement, he mused. Almost 6 months had passed since Imran had mailed his brother the DVDs, and he only now was hearing back from him. When he did, it was in the form of another encrypted book code email advising him of a special family celebration taking place in Syria that he should return home for. Imran knew that this message meant that the seed he planted had grown into something significant, something that he hoped was very special indeed. As he had no family to be concerned about, he had his office manager clear his schedule for a month's vacation and began to pack. He hired a service to box the contents of his home and pack them in a shipping container bound for Syria. Due to trade imbalances, there was very little freight leaving U.S. ports these days. Shipping all of his belongings home only cost him $600 American. With his surgical skills, he could start a new life, perhaps in Dubai, a place he'd long wanted to visit. He had savings sufficient to make that happen. On his last day in the United States, Imran made his financial arrangements and had his bank accounts transferred to offshore accounts that he could access from anywhere in the world. He took several $1,000s in cash, which he dispersed throughout his luggage and on his person. He drove his Mercedes to the airport and left it in long-term parking, where it would sit for a very long time. Later, aboard the plane, the U.S. receded from his window. He thanked the country for his medical education and hoped that it emerged from its hardships a better nation than the one he was leaving. A more humble nation. A more spiritual nation. Perhaps even a Muslim nation. On that same day, a Muslim grocer in Detroit received an encoded set of instructions from a Muslim in Germany via an encrypted email. He was instructed to contact 4 men across the United States, each the leader of a cell of men who had sworn their lives to jihad. The men were previously unknown to the grocer, and he was given a specific greeting to use with each of the men. When these men would hear his greeting, they would know that Allah was calling for them. Each cell leader had a specific response he was to recite back to the man from Detroit. When the grocer received the correct response, the men's identities would be confirmed, and they would be given a set of instructions. The 4 cell leaders would then contact each of the members of their cell and pass along further instructions. Some men were to purchase handheld GPS units commonly used for backpacking or hunting. Several were to purchase ATVs and trailers for hauling them behind vehicles. 1 was instructed to buy a pop-up camping trailer. 2 dozen men were told to purchase hunting licenses, camouflage clothing, and scoped hunting rifles in .30-06 caliber. They were told to practice and become proficient with the weapons. Other men had no specific instructions other than to wait for a call. They were all given 1 week to prepare themselves and pray for their success. On a Friday, 2 dozen ISIS-trained terrorists converged on the U.S. and crossed its borders illegally. 6 crossed remote border sections in the forests of Washington State on backpacking trails used by marijuana smugglers. Several entered Texas, smuggled across the border by a drug cartel that was paid in cash and asked no questions. Others crossed from Windsor, Canada, into Detroit in the trunks of cars. The remainder arrived on the Florida and Georgia coasts, transported by high-speed cigarette cruisers. Each of these groups was met by a cell member and issued a duffel bag with false identification, clothes, a handgun, extra clips and ammunition, a prepaid cell phone, and the phone number for a cell member they would be paired with for their segment of the operation. Each man was given a key attached to a white tag. Written on each man's tag were a different set of GPS coordinates. Bilal spoke not a word of English, but he would not need it for his business here. He used his prepaid phone to contact the cell member assigned to him, a Tampa waiter named Ali. When Ali arrived to pick him up, he asked Bilal's name. Bilal did not reply, nor did he ask for Ali's name. Ali had no training and had never been called into an operation before. He was nervous and didn't know how he was supposed to act. He realized that with his attempts at camaraderie and friendly small talk, he probably appeared amateurish, or worse, westernized. "Did you rent the house as instructed?" Bilal asked.
"I did,"
Ali replied. "Did you gather the things that you were asked to gather?"
"I purchased everything. Everything was done exactly in the manner in which I was instructed."
They spent that night at Ali's apartment and left the next morning in Ali's recently purchased minivan. He bought it used with cash he received in the mail. As instructed, he had removed the seats. Using the handheld GPS, the pair sought the coordinates written on the key tag that Bilal had been given upon his arrival. The coordinates led them to a self-storage facility and to a particular block of units hidden in the dense maze of metal structures. Bilal's key fit unit 437. He opened the lock and raised the door. Inside were several large plastic trunks about 4 feet long and 2 feet wide.
"What are these things?" Ali asked.
Bilal did not answer, but gestured to the man to help him load them in the vehicle.
"The boxes are heavy,"
Ali commented. When they had closed the unit back up and were back on the road, Bilal asked Ali if he had studied the route that he had been asked to study. He replied that he had. "Then take us to Baton Rouge, Louisiana," Bilal said, "to the house you rented. Do not exceed the speed limit."
"What then?" Ali asked. "What will we do there?"
"When there is something you need to know, you will be told." For a week, Ali and Bilal stayed in their rented house in Baton Rouge. In the back bedroom was a chest freezer Ali had purchased at the Home Depot, around 4 feet long and 3 feet deep. Beside it was a large plastic tub of water. Each hour, Bilal reached into the freezer and removed what Ali now suspected were mortar shells. There were two of them, and Bilal would dip the nose end of each into the water and then replace it in the freezer. Over the last couple of days, the nose end of each shell had grown about an inch thicker with ice. When Bilal was satisfied with his work, he sent Ali to Walmart to purchase a large white marine cooler, which he was further instructed to fill with dry ice. That night, as Bilal knelt on the living room floor and recited his prayers, he received a text message containing a set of numbers. Referring to a small notebook in his pocket, Bilal was able to transpose the encoded numbers until he ascertained the intended message. It was another set of GPS coordinates. When he was done translating the message, Bilal went to Ali. "It is time." By 2 a.m., Bilal and Ali were concealed in a stand of trees approximately 1 mile from ExxonMobil's Baton Rouge refinery. It was one of the largest oil refineries in America, capable of producing over a 500,000 barrels of oil a day. While the distance was nearly at the limits of the 81-millimeter mortar's range, Bilal had extensive experience with the weapon in Iraq and was more than capable of hitting such a large and highly flammable target as the refinery. The weapon consisted of 4 manageable pieces: the cannon, the mount, the base plate, and the sighting unit. He and Ali had hauled the plastic trunks into the woods beside the road and then carried each piece to this specific site, exactly where the coordinates Bilal received earlier had instructed him to set up his weapon. When the weapon was assembled, Bilal had Ali return each plastic trunk to the vehicle while he sighted the weapon. Bilal removed one of the ice-encrusted high-explosive mortar shells and placed it gently into the firing tube. The base of the shell slid easily into the tube, but when the ice-encrusted section hit the tube, it was too large from the encrustation of ice and would not slide further inside. This was by design and exactly as planned. The shell would hang partially exposed from the barrel, where it would stay until the ice melted.
"Genius," Ali uttered.
"We have used this method in Iraq," Bilal said. "When the ice melts, the round slips down the tube and strikes the firing pin, firing the round."
"How much time do we have?" Ali asked.
"In this heat, less than an hour, I expect," Bilal replied. "Let us go. We have another to set up, and not much time." After the second mortar installation was set up, they returned to the rented house to empty the trunks and cooler from their vehicles. While Ali carried two of the trunks down the hallway, Bilal stepped up behind him with a suppressed Walther P-22 and emptied two quick rounds into the back of Ali's head. As Ali slumped forward, Bilal unscrewed the suppressor and stowed it along with the weapon in his pocket. Bilal watched without expression as Ali's body stiffened and spasmed, the brain dead, but the body not yet aware of that fact. When the gyrations stopped, Bilal dragged Ali's body to the back bedroom and wrestled him into the chest freezer. Bilal then walked back through the house, locked the door behind him, and departed in Ali's van. In the back of the van there remained one large plastic trunk. Inside were one dozen M-72 light anti-tank weapons, otherwise known as LAWs. They were compact weapons, around 2 feet closed and weighing only 5 pounds. Their range was nearly 1,000 meters. In Bilal's pocket were more GPS coordinates and a list of secondary targets. With his primary objective completed, he could proceed with taking out those other targets. He allowed himself a quick flush of pride. The night would be glorious. As Bilal drove into the night, the ice on his mortar shell had melted sufficiently that it was no longer able to resist the downward pull of gravity. What ice remained slipped free, and the shell dropped down the tube. With a loud pop, the shell struck the firing pin. The primer ignited the propelling charge, and the missile arced toward the refinery. Those working outside the refinery that night heard the noise and saw the arc of the shell coming toward them. A few veterans even recognized the signature sound of a mortar round and ran for their lives. It would have been impossible to run far enough, though. At the end of the projectile's path, the detonating nose of the mortar shell struck a gasoline storage tank and exploded instantly. What ensued was a massive series of explosions that would result in tremendous loss of human life, as well as damage to the refinery that would render it inoperative for more than a year. However, that was not the end of this long night. All of the ISIS terrorists at work that night were able to achieve their primary targets and the majority of their secondary targets. In operations identical to Bilal's, fuel refineries across the south were struck by 81-millimeter mortars from ranges of 0.5 to 1 mile. The Baytown refinery in Baytown, Texas, the nation's largest, went up in flames, as did the smaller Texas City refinery. In Louisiana, the Lake Charles refinery and the Beaumont refinery were also destroyed. In the Midwest, the Whiting refinery in Indiana was set ablaze by a 27-year-old Iraqi operative named Wahid. In 1 hour, the United States lost the capacity to refine 3 million barrels of oil each day. In remote sections of Alaska, two terrorists 100 miles apart used shaped charges on short timers to disable the Alaskan pipeline. Each man carried 10 charges in a backpack and followed the pipeline on an ATV, randomly placing charges and setting timers to detonate in 30 minutes or less. In Russell County, Kentucky, a 32-year-old Syrian named Faisal used a stolen American Javelin anti-tank weapon to place a shell in a weak earthen section of the fragile Wolf Creek Dam. Before his very eyes, the earth began to crumble, and within minutes, water was pouring through the dam and making its way toward Nashville. The entire city would be flooded by morning. In the Hampton Roads, Newport News area of Virginia, an American of Iraqi descent named Hasnat drove his catering van through the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. In the seat beside him was the ISIS operative he'd been assigned to transport around the city. Hasnat was unsure of the nature of their operation, only that the van was full of boxes and that his guests did not feel him worthy of knowing what was inside them. As the bridge turned to a tunnel and moved beneath the bay, Hasnat sensed a change in his guest and suspected that he may be claustrophobic. When Hasnat turned to speak to the passenger, he saw the remote control in the man's hand and immediately understood. With only the first word of his prayer on his tongue, Hasnat's vehicle detonated and removed a 70-foot section of this marvel of engineering. With Javelin anti-tank weapons and 81-millimeter mortars, explosive shells rained from fields and rooftops upon the Golden Gate Bridge, the Brooklyn Bridge, the Watts Bar Nuclear Power Station, the Diablo Canyon Power Plant, and a string of other power plants. When the terrorists achieved their targets, each followed Bilal's lead and executed the cell member assigned as their escort, erasing their tracks. Other than the two men working the Alaskan pipeline, each terrorist was assigned multiple secondary targets within the Eastern, Western, or Texas interconnection power grids. Some had LAW rockets. Others, dressed in camouflage and armed with .30-06 hunting rifles, began firing into crucial and difficult-to-replace transformers at select power stations. As high-voltage lines and crucial power stations within the grid were destroyed, the majority of the United States began to go dark. Power failed, along with communication, transportation, medical services. Law enforcement would soon fail as well, taking the peace of a nation with it. Chapter 2. I had never been fond of staying in hotels. I'd worked for the same state agency in southwestern Virginia for over 20 years now, and I'd had to make the 5-hour trip to Richmond more times than I could count. The distance always required staying in a hotel, and unlike some people, I didn't enjoy staying in hotels. However, Richmond was our state capital, and every time there was some change in the regulations governing our agency, we had to send a group up here to see how it was going to affect us. It was where the important meetings were always held. 6 of us made the trip up yesterday, and our meeting was supposed to start at 10 a.m. I was hoping that it ended early, and we could hit the road back toward home. All of these thoughts hit me as soon as I woke up from my restless sleep. I hadn't even gone to my meeting yet, and already I was thinking about heading home. I never slept well in hotels, and the sheets here reeked of bleach to the point that my eyes burned. I rolled out of bed. My immediate plan to hit the hotel fitness room for some me time with the stationary bike and my iPod before heading down to the tasteless and disappointing continental breakfast with my colleagues. Having a good workout prior to a day-long meeting in Richmond at least made me feel like I'd accomplished something, unlike when I sat in those meetings. I looked toward the bedside digital clock to check the time, but it was blank. It took me a second to register the oddity of that in my groggy state. Then I noticed that the bathroom light I left on last night was not on either. I staggered to the dresser and retrieved my watch. 5:30 a.m., my regular time to wake up. I moved toward the window and pulled open the blinds. The sky was just beginning to lighten at the horizon, but it was still mostly dark outside. I saw some vehicles moving around, but noticed that there were no security lights functioning in the parking lot. That was odd. Hotel parking lots were always lit up like football fields here in Richmond because of the crime. No street lights were illuminated. I could see one intersection from my window, and that traffic light was not working either. I started looking around at other hotels and office buildings visible from my window. All were dark. There had to be a power outage. I'd never been in a hotel during a power outage before, but I could only assume it would make staying in a hotel suck even worse. No elevators, no hot water, and eventually no water at all. No shitty continental breakfast, either. I went back to the dresser and picked up my iPhone. I touched a button, and the screen glowed. I opened a news app, and it attempted to update with the morning's news, but it appeared to have a poor data connection, as the page that loaded was missing blocks of text and images. Only a red headline was visible. America, Nation Under Attack. Shit. What had I missed last night? I closed the app, touched an icon, and dialed my wife's cell number. After a few misleading rings, I received a message that all circuits were busy. I sat down on the bed and attempted to collect my thoughts, but it was like herding cats. I was too sluggish from poor sleep. I went to the bathroom and tried the sink. There was still some water pressure, so I splashed cold water on my face in the dark. Without power, there wouldn't even be water up here much longer. When the city's booster pumps failed, the upper stories of buildings, like the one I was in now, would be the first to experience the loss in pressure. I grabbed a towel and dried off, feeling slightly more alert. I dragged my suitcase closer to the window and dug out some clothes, dressing quickly since I wasn't sure at this point if I'd actually be attending my meeting or not. I remembered something I'd read once before about how it was easier to send a text message with a poor signal than to make a call. A text could go through with sporadic connectivity, while a cell call required a more stable connection with better signal quality. I got my phone and sat back down, opened the messaging app, and typed, "No power here." Saw a headline about an attack. "Are you and kids okay?" I set the phone down and picked up my shoes. I'd brought dress shoes for my meeting, but my everyday shoes are Keen hiking boots, and that's what I put on. I didn't know what the day would bring, but I couldn't imagine the meeting was still on the agenda, if for no other reason than I couldn't imagine the women of our party going out in public without being able to shower and do their hair. I surveyed the room in the dim light and tried to collect my belongings. I picked up any scattered clothes and crammed them into the bag. I went to the dresser and used the light from my phone to gather my EDC, or everyday carry, items. My billfold, change, keys, my SOG Twitch XL knife, and a little Ruger LCP 380 pistol. The LCP had an inside-the-belt holster that allowed me to carry it discreetly inside my pants and hidden by my shirt. I had a permit to carry it, although our agency policy prohibited carrying it in company vehicles or at the office. I did so anyway, because I would rather have it when I needed it than die at the hands of a criminal, while secure in the fact that I was dying in compliance with the agency policy manual. If bad things happened, I would survive to find another job. I would not die and have my tombstone read, "Here lies Jim, he adhered to policy." I tucked the pistol away and the text alert on my phone sounded off. I saw it was my wife, breathed a sigh of relief, and read the message. "Not sure what's going on. Just woke up. We have power." I quickly typed a reply. "Don't know what is happening, but assume you will lose power too. Get red folder out of gun safe and follow instructions immediately. Text me back if you figure out what happened. Love you, and will be home as soon as I can." I hit send. I had seen enough cell towers up close to know that many of them had propane generators for power failures. How long they stayed up varied. All it took in a network was one failure along the chain and the whole network would start to sag. The system was already overburdened, and one glitch could cause a massive backup in data transmission. Kind of like when some jerk at the office decided to print 500 brochures on the office printer, and the massive job would keep anyone else from printing for hours. I hoped my wife got the message. I had trained her and the kids on surviving emergencies, but I never knew if they were taking me seriously. whether they were actually listening or just humoring me. I tried to explain to them that they may need those skills if bad things happened. I hoped they had taken it to heart, because bad things might be happening right now. The area we lived in got its power from coal-fired plants that were only about 15 miles away from my home. With a supply of coal, they would continue on for a while, and the coal was all local, too. The problem I anticipated was that with demand surging, the power company would be trying to send as much of that power upstream as possible to the more populated areas of Northern Virginia. Under this pressure, something would break. Components would overheat and fail, or a transformer would pop. Something they would not be able to replace would break, and then the folks at home would be in the dark, too. I got up and did a final check of the room, gathering my jacket, my bag, and the backpack that I carried to the room last night after everyone else had gone to their rooms. I didn't want to have to explain the backpack to them, because taking it everywhere I traveled made me seem paranoid. I preferred to look at myself as well-informed. I knew what kind of crazy shit could happen in the world, and I wanted to be as ready as I could. The backpack was my emergency get-home bag, or GHB, and it went where I went. I brought it in last night because I didn't like leaving it in the car overnight. There were items in there that could save my life in an emergency. Today, I might need it. It really wasn't paranoia, though. What changed me was seeing our nation undergo events like Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Sandy. We as a nation just didn't have the ability we once had to step in and come to the rescue of our citizens. Or maybe it was just that people were less self-sufficient than they used to be and were brought to their knees more easily by bumps in the road. Either way, I had children and a wife that I was responsible for. And with that responsibility came paranoia. I didn't want to be one of those people unable to take care of my family. I didn't want to have to take them to shelters and depend on someone else to feed us. I wanted to have a backup plan. The get-home bag was part of it. I started to leave the room, but was afraid to leave my stuff behind, afraid the door might not open again, even though I was sure that the lock was battery-powered and would function even during an outage. I couldn't take a chance on being separated from my gear, though. I went to the door and pulled it open, leaving my pack and luggage in the door, propping it open. I stepped out into the hallway and realized how alien it was to be in a completely darkened hotel hallway. There were no exit lights, no smoke detector LEDs, no overhead lights, no blinking security cameras. There was no buzz and clicking of ice machines or soda machines. There was no sound of CNN or Bloomberg coming faintly from the rooms of early rising business travelers. No one stirred. I stepped across the hall using the flashlight app on my phone to light the way. I tapped on a door. Nothing. I tapped again until I heard movement inside.
"Well, who is it?"
asked a groggy voice. It was Gary Sullivan, the IT director at our agency. He'd worked there almost as long as I had, and we were pretty good friends, mostly because he was slightly paranoid like me. Excuse me, I mean well-informed. Having a paranoid friend made each of us feel slightly less paranoid, though. That was just the kind of supportive relationship any well-prepared individual needs. "It's Jim," I replied. The door cracked, and Gary opened it slightly.
"What's going on? What time is it?"
"I think the shit hit the fan," I said. Gary had a blank look on his face. He shielded his eyes from the light of my phone.
"What? What the hell are you talking about?"
"The power's out. Some kind of attack. I don't know anything yet, but something is definitely going on." Gary perked up.
"Give me a few minutes," he said. "I'll be right out."
I retreated to my room and began to assess our situation. There were six of us here, in two cars, two men, four women. We were slightly over 300 miles from home. We did not know what was going on yet. There could be limited access to fuel due to the power outages, and even limitations on travel, depending on the scale of the emergency. We were not equipped for a long journey. We were way too short on information. It was at that moment that I remembered my iPod had a radio receiver built into it. I'd never used it because who the hell listens to the radio anymore? I don't. My iPod was for audiobooks, podcasts, and workout music. I dug it out of my jacket pocket and stuck the earbuds in my ears. I selected the radio feature from the menu and began trying to figure it out. I started scanning through channels, finding mostly static, before I landed on a station that was playing what sounded like an emergency broadcast system recording. It was the flat, monotone voice of someone reading a prepared statement. Eventually, the statement began to repeat itself, and included mention of the fact that it was indeed an EBS statement and to stay tuned for further updates. The President of the United States has declared a nationwide state of emergency in response to the widespread and devastating terror attacks that occurred in the United States overnight. We do not know yet who is responsible for the heinous actions that have shattered the peace of our nation. As it has not yet been determined if the attacks are over or if we continue to be at risk, Americans are encouraged to stay at home and limit travel only to emergency situations. Roadways should be kept clear for emergency vehicles, first responders, and those attempting to repair the damage caused during the attacks. Several major fuel refineries were destroyed in the attack, and fuel may be rationed until such time as we're able to assess and take inventory of the available fuel inventory. The procedure for limiting fuel sales has not been finalized, but Americans should be aware that this may occur. Estimates are that over 65% of homes in the country are without power, and it is not known when service will be restored. Americans are urged to conserve water, utilize their family emergency plans and resources, and stay tuned for further updates. Until the situation is stable, each American is encouraged to help his neighbor, and we will get through this together. May God bless the United States of America. When the message began to repeat itself, I turned the iPod off. There was a knock on the door, and I pulled the earbuds from my ears and went to the door. It was Gary.
"You ever figure out what was going on?"
he asked. "I just listened to an emergency broadcast system message on my iPod," I told him. "There's been some kind of terrorist attack affecting fuel supplies and the power grid. A lot of the country is without power. Fuel supply is limited, and they're telling everyone to stay home until they know more." Gary stood there for a moment, absorbing that information without a reaction. He didn't appear to be a morning person. All cylinders were not yet firing.
"I think we need to get everyone together and get the hell out of here," he finally said. "Things could deteriorate quickly, and we're a long way from home. This is the last place I want to be stuck."
"I agree. Let's get everyone together, then, and tell them what we know." Gary went one way, and I went the other, each of us waking up two sleeping women, and thereby sharing the danger equally. All of the women, seasoned travelers, responded to my knocking by calling through the door rather than opening it. We each gave them a condensed version of the little we knew, telling them that we needed to assemble in my room in 10 minutes and get a plan together. They were not happy campers. Gary and I were sitting in my room talking as the women began showing up. I could hear Lois Green, the head of the accounting department, complaining all the way down the hall. She would no doubt blame me for all of this. As far as she was concerned, I was the root of all evil. "What's this all about, Jim?" she demanded. "Gary said it was a national emergency and he would tell us more when we got here." She sounded very put out by being dragged out of bed and not given time to prepare herself. She was a minister's wife, and the two of us did not really get along. She represented a lot of the things that I disliked the most in people. She gossiped, backstabbed, and lied, while maintaining a facade that she was above such things. I was pretty sure she thought I was the devil incarnate, but I wasn't losing sleep over it. "We don't have a lot of information," I told her, as everyone else came in. "There's obviously no power here, but my wife says we still have it at home. I heard a broadcast on the emergency broadcast system a few minutes ago that said there'd been terrorist attacks last night. The fuel supply has been affected, and the power to more than half of the country is out.
They're telling people to limit travel and stay off the roads.
What do you think we should do? Alice Watkins, the human resources director, asked.
She and I got along pretty well most of the time, but she was a stickler for the rules, since she wrote a lot of them. She and I were part of a policy team and had spent hours developing the policies that bound our agency. She was the one who had written that particular policy about carrying weapons in agency vehicles that I'd been breaking on a regular basis. I was hoping she wasn't going to advocate for staying put just because the government told her to. If that was the case, I'd have to leave her ass in the parking lot. Taking orders from the government was not my style. "I'm not interested in staying in Richmond," I said. "I think that would be a dumb, potentially dangerous move." Gary, ever the more tactful and polite speaker, took it upon himself to act as my translator. "What Jim is trying to say is that there are a lot of risks with staying here," he said, trying to put a friendlier face on things. "The government could institute martial law or curfews, particularly here in Richmond. Jim heard that they're going to limit the fuel supply. Then we'd have a long walk home. It's almost like we have to go before they get organized and tell us we can't." The women soaked this up in silence. Jim looked at the other two women, Rebecca Dowdy and Randy Ward, both from the clinical side of the agency.
"Any opinions?"
he asked the women. "What about staying put and waiting to see what happens?" Randy asked. "That might be the safest move." "I don't think it's a good idea," I repeated. "Do you remember Hurricane Katrina? Imagine that devastation on a national scale. People are civil now and things are relatively stable, but things will get much, much worse before they get better. Richmond in particular will have more people than food, and things will get very bad in a few days. As stores run out of food, people will get desperate, and desperate people become violent. Meanwhile, our families will be home worrying about us." "Run out of food? Stores won't run out of food that quickly," Lois snarled at me as if I were some vile creature. "It's called just-in-time inventory, Lois," I said. "Most stores don't keep more than 3 days' worth of food. If there's panic buying, the stores may be empty within a day if they don't receive trucks. If fuel sales are limited, those trucks may not come." Lois was ignoring me, as she often did, and was fooling with her phone. "I couldn't get through to my husband," Lois said. "I tried to call him while we were walking down here." I wasn't sure what was relevant about that, but Lois seemed to think that whatever passed through her head was important to the rest of us. "You might try texting," I suggested. "That'll sometimes go through when a call can't." Lois looked at me like I was personally responsible for her call not going through. "Must be nice to be an expert on everything," she said. "But I guess I'll try that." I rolled my eyes at her. "Try it or not," I said. "I don't care either way." As HR director, Alice was used to mediating disagreements, often involving me. "Arguing won't get us anywhere," she said. "Are we in agreement that we want to try and get home now, or does some of you want to stay?" She looked around. "Lois, stay or go?" Lois shot me a nasty look. "Go, I guess." I shrugged. She continued to act as if I had personally brought this down upon us. I was so glad we were in separate cars. "Rebecca?" Alice asked. Rebecca was a tall, dark-haired triathlete who ran our drug treatment center. She was blunt and tough as nails from working with manipulative substance abusers every day. "Go," she said. "Randy?" Alice asked. Randy was short and fiery-tempered. She ran residential programs for folks with disabilities and hated meetings as much as I did. "Oh, I don't like Richmond anyway," she said. "I want to get the hell out of here." "I'm assuming you guys both think we should go, too?" Alice asked Gary and me. We both nodded. "Well, I'm in agreement with everyone else," she said. She looked at me. "Anything else to decide, or do we just get in our cars and go?"
"Well, we could ride together in one car," Gary said. "That way we wouldn't get separated." Lois snorted.
"I'm not riding in a car with him," she said, nodding in my direction. "I prefer not to listen to his foul language." I bit back any smart-ass comments. It would just be a waste of time. I would take the high road.
Fine, I said. Let's just ride back with who we came with, then. Grab your stuff, and let's be out of here in 5 minutes.
Well, the women went to get their bags, Gary and I stood in the hall.
Lois, I said, shaking my head. I don't know about her.
Gary held up a hand to silence me.
I can't be mean to her, he said. It's like mistreating my mother.
If your mother acts like that, she deserves mistreatment.
He scowled at me and changed the subject.
I don't recall you filling up the car when we got here.
I didn't, I replied. I usually prefer to, but I just didn't.
I hated leaving a car low on gas and fussed at my wife about it all the time, but I'd just done the same thing.
How much gas did we have? He asked.
A little more than a quarter tank?
Not nearly enough to make it home.
Let's hope we can find a station with power and get more.
Gary nodded grimly.
Chapter 3
After the text from her husband, Jim's wife Ellen picked up the remote and turned on the TV in their bedroom. Some of the cable channels were out, but CNN was still broadcasting, and she stopped there. The scale of devastation was almost too much to take in. Explosions and attacks had taken place across the whole country, and there was little information. No one knew who was responsible or if it was even over yet. She saw enough, though, to recognize signs of the cascading systems failure that Jim always warned against. The warning signs were all there. Enough things were failing that the whole fabric of society could come undone. The question no one could answer was for how long. Jim talked about this stuff enough that even the kids were well-versed in disaster preparation. They'd seen a lot of programs on the Learning Channel, Discovery, and the Science Channel about how disaster scenarios could play out. By now, the entire family was aware of certain facts about disasters. Disruptions in communication led to panic, rumors, and fear. Disruptions in the fuel supply led to food shortages, interruptions in various services that people expected, and high costs for what fuel was available. Disruptions in power led to fear, looting, and deaths. In the winter, people froze without power. In the summer, they suffocated from a lack of air conditioning. Without power, people who relied on medical devices would likely pass away if the interruption was of any duration at all. From what little Ellen could see, she knew there could be long-term disruptions in all of these areas. Jim's worst scenarios were playing out in living color. She got out of bed, put on her robe, and went to the gun safe that Jim kept in their walk-in closet. She knew the combination by heart. She had been practically forced to memorize it, and Jim drilled her on the importance of being able to get weapons to protect the children in an emergency. Inside the gun safe was a red binder that Jim had shown her many times. He'd never made her read it, just made sure she knew where it was so that she could get to it in an emergency. She took the binder out of the safe, took a seat on the bed, and opened the book. Inside were neatly typed tabs and dividers. There were sections labeled insurance policies, finances, and home information. It was the kind of stuff that a responsible husband left for his wife to make sure that she would know where things were if he died suddenly. Toward the end of the binder were red tabs with labels that read Situation Normal, Situation Elevated, Situation Critical, and Bug Out. Situation Normal dealt with everyday emergency preparations that Jim normally took care of, but wanted her to be able to handle should he not be there. There were things he felt were very important to assure their safety, such as making sure that they had a supply of emergency water, emergency food, and emergency fuel. Included was a schedule for rotating those items to make sure that the oldest was used first, and to make sure those items were continually resupplied so that they didn't run out. There were also instructions for turning off the water and power. Basic stuff. The list Jim wanted her to look for this morning was under Situation Elevated. She knew that from many, many reminders over the years. She opened that section and began reading. In an elevated situation, there may be reason to suspect that access to resources may be compromised for the short or long term. Stores will face an interruption in supply if fuel is limited. We've made preparations for this, but efforts should be made to secure more of the following items if it can be done without substantial risk. 1. Additional food. 2. Additional fuel. 3. Additional cash. As you'll be carrying cash to make these purchases, and since panic or rioting could occur at any moment during times of fear and high emotion, you should make certain that you have your concealed weapon and permit on you for your protection. It should be carried in an available, easily accessible manner and not buried in a glove compartment or purse. A round should be in the chamber so that the weapon can be fired quickly without having to rack the slide and chamber around. As long as you handle the weapon in the manner that we've discussed and trained on, it will not be dangerous to carry the weapon hot. If times and conditions permit, proceed with the following. Take cash from the emergency money in the gun safe in case power is down or debit card processing technology is down. If cards can be used, do so and save the cash for later. 1. Load all empty fuel cans into the back of the Suburban. 2. Go to the bank and withdraw $2,500 from savings in smaller denominations. 3. Go to the gas station and fill cans. Gas in red, diesel in yellow. Pay with a card if it'll work. Use cash if needed. If there's a line of panic buyers, go ahead and get in line. It'll only be worse and more expensive later. Be alert that your vehicle does not get penned in. Always leave room in front of you to get out if you need to. 4. Remove the list from the next page and buy what you can. Take the kids and have them each push a cart to allow for more purchases. And 5. Be careful. Ellen took the list from the sleeve and looked it over, then went to wake up the kids. 15 minutes later, she was driving down the road with 2 sleepy and unhappy children. Pete and Ariel were 13 and 11. And a pretty good mix of their mom and dad's looks and personalities. Pete took more of his mom's temperament, though, with his soft heart and sensitivity. Ariel was a no-nonsense spitfire of a girl, clearly her father's daughter. Ellen filled them in on the news of the day and the task their father had laid out for them. "Is this the apocalypse?" Ariel asked, rolling her eyes. "No," Ellen said. "There's just an emergency, and Dad wants us to be prepared in case the stores run low." "When is Dad coming home?" Pete asked. Ellen composed her reply carefully. "Dad is starting home now, but it may take longer than normal. Traffic may be slow because of the emergency." Pete sat back and thought about it. Ellen could tell that this would worry him. "Sounds like the crap hit the fan," Ariel said.
"Ariel,"
Ellen said. "That's no way for a little girl to talk." In the
rearview
mirror, Ellen could see Pete grinning at his sister. He was always amused by the things that came out of her mouth. Ellen got the money from the bank without incident and crossed the street to the convenience store where she frequently bought gas. She thought there would be a line already, as any sort of crisis pushed people to buy gas before they did anything else. There were few farmers and early risers getting coffee and breakfast biscuits, but she only had to wait behind one vehicle at the pump. When it moved, she filled her tank, then the red gas cans, letting Pete lift them back into the vehicle for her. She was glad that he was getting big enough to help with these kinds of things. He was as tall as she was now, and a big kid. Once the red cans were all filled, she moved around to the diesel pump and did the same with the yellow cans. Walmart was about 5 minutes away, and that was her next stop. When she pulled into the parking lot, she saw that it was no more crowded than any other morning about this time. "I guess no one else got the memo," Ariel said. "It's only 6:30 in the morning," Pete said. "Most people are still in bed. Reasonable people, anyway." "I wish I was one of them," Ariel muttered. Ellen parked the Suburban, and they headed toward the entrance. Ellen reminding the kids of why they were there so early. "The problem, Ariel, is that most stores don't carry more than 3 days' worth of inventory now. They have trucks coming in all the time. Those trucks can be delayed by power outages, fuel shortages, or damaged roads, and then the shelves will be empty. What will people do for food then?" I guess they eat those old cans of beets and lima beans from the back of their cabinets, Pete said with a grin.
Black, Ariel said.
I agree, said Ellen.
Black.
As Jim's binder instructed them, each of them took a cart, although Ellen was not sure Ariel could manage one if it was very full. She made a mental note to give her paper products and lighter items. Ariel looked at the list as Ellen read over it, trying to get a picture in her head of how to go about this.
What are we going to do with all this junk if this isn't the end of the world, Mom? She asked.
It's all stuff we'll use eventually, Ellen said. Just think of it as shopping in advance.
I want some bananas, Pete said.
Sorry, bud, we're focusing on items that last a long time today, she said. Then thinking better of it, told him,
Go ahead. If things get hard, we might not see any bananas for a while.
Why? Where do they come from? Ariel asked.
South America, Ellen said.
That'll be a long way to go for a banana, if you have to walk. After Pete added his bananas, Ellen went to a display of packaged nuts, trail mixes, and dehydrated fruit slices. She threw an assortment in the cart, then skipped frozen foods and picked up a few loaves of bread, some of which she would freeze when they got home. She got a half dozen of the largest jars of peanut butter they had, several large jars of jelly, 15 pounds of coffee, and several boxes of tea.
I love peanut butter, Ariel said.
We all love peanut butter, Pete chimed in. I hope that's enough.
I hope it is, too, Ellen said. But if it's not, there's powdered peanut butter in the basement pantry.
Sounds nasty, Ariel said.
You guys can have it.
You might be singing a different tune if we go through all this, Pete warned. They continued through the aisles, filling the carts with 20 pounds of rice, 20 pounds of beans, 2 dozen different kinds of noodles, dried soup mixes, ramen, flour, sugar, salt, and other spices, pancake mix, syrup, ketchup, tomato sauces, tuna, and dozens of other items. They bought several canned hams that had a 10-year shelf life. They filled Ariel's cart with toilet paper, paper towels, aluminum foil, paper plates, plasticware, garbage bags, and baggies.
I thought Dad already had all this stuff, Ariel said in complaint as she pushed her cart through the store. Why do we have to buy more?
He does, honey, Ellen replied. But he's concerned we'll need more, and he wants us to be safe and well taken care of. He doesn't want us to run out.
Where are we going now? Pete asked, fighting to push his cart due to a bad wheel that rattled as they walked through the store.
Camping section, Ellen said. Once there, they collected green propane cylinders, 5-gallon cans of Coleman fuel, isobutane canisters for Jim's backpacking stove, and extra mantles for the propane lanterns. They picked up 10 boxes of kitchen matches, several dozen cheap butane lighters, and 2 dozen slow-burning candles. Their carts were full by now, and they were all struggling to push them.
Are we done yet? Ariel asked, groaning.
Well, there's more on the list, Ellen said. I think we'll go put all this in the car, and then I'll come back and get the last items. Shouldn't be more than a single cart full.
Good, Ariel said. I need to rest.
They proceeded to the checkout, where Ellen was a little self-conscious about the quantities they were buying. However, this was Walmart, and they were used to seeing everything. The 3 carts didn't even raise an eyebrow. Ellen was able to pay with her debit card, preserving the cash. Once she had her 2-foot-long receipt tucked into her purse, they struggled out the door, across the parking lot, to their vehicle. Ellen looked around the nearly empty parking lot and felt like it was reasonably safe.
"You guys unload this," Ellen said. "It'll be faster if I go run back in now while you two are taking care of this."
Ariel groaned again and rolled her eyes, but Pete took charge, and they had a system going by the time Ellen turned her back and began walking back to the store. She got another cart and headed for the pharmacy section of the store. Despite knowing that Jim already had much of this stuff, she followed his instructions to the letter and purchased more peroxide, alcohol, antibiotic ointment, bandages, and over-the-counter medications for everything from colds to diarrhea. She bought hand sanitizer, soap, large bottles of shampoo, and deodorant. Realizing she'd missed a few things, she ran back to the grocery aisle and bought 3 large bottles of bleach. She had to make a trip to the automotive department to pick up fuel stabilizer for all the gas they'd purchased. A few more small items, and she was done. Checking out, she was again self-conscious, especially since she was in the same line she'd been in earlier with the same checkout girl. However, there was perhaps no employee anywhere in the